The following message is by Pastor John Piper. More information from Desiring God is available at www.desiringgod.org.
We're going to try to really hasten through this next talk. I would really love for there to be questions, but we'll see if you can stay. The title of this paper is, Was Jonathan Edwards a Christian Hedonist? And I think what I need to do first is say a sentence or two to try to sum up what I mean by Christian hedonism, though it's taken a book to do that, and then say why it matters to me that I ask this question about Edwards, and then just jump right into it and argue for my thesis, namely that he is. Christian hedonism, I would say, has as its basic point that my pursuit of satisfaction in life and God's pursuit of His own glory are not at odds, but that God is the kind of God who, if you forsake your pursuit of happiness, cannot be glorified by you. And, putting it positively, the way to glorify God is by enjoying Him forever. You bring glory to a fountain, not by dumping your water in, but by drinking it and saying, ah, by enjoying the fountain. Anybody that tries to work for God rather than enjoying God is an insult to His all-sufficiency. Then a second thing to say would be, and this is what I'm going to talk about tonight, that all virtue, all true virtue, must involve the enjoyment of the glory of God. In two senses, all true virtue must involve the enjoyment of the experience of the grace of God. I get that from 1 Corinthians 15:10. By the grace of God, I am what I am, and His grace toward me was not in vain, but I worked harder than any of them. Nevertheless, it was not I, but the grace of God that was with me. Anybody that attempts to obey God and is not pursuing the delightful enjoyment of the experience of that sovereign grace in and through all acts of obedience is not truly virtuous in a biblical sense. And in the second sense that we experience the glory of God in all of our virtue is that all virtue must be done with a view to enjoying the promotion of God's glory. That is, one of the things we delight in when we perform an act of virtue that may cost us our life is the delight in the fact that men will see our good deeds and give glory to our Father in heaven. In other words, the pursuit of joy in the glory of God is a necessary component of all virtuous acts. You must be a hedonist in this sense in order to be a truly virtuous person. There must be an element of gladness of heart in all acts and a Godward gladness of heart that delights in His targeting me with grace and delights in that reflecting back to Him to His glory. Now, that may not be as clear and as compelling as you would like it to be, since I just summed up six pages of the paper there. But I think as I unfold Edwards, it will become much clearer and you will see why I say that my thesis is what I have written in Desiring God is intended to be, and I believe is. I have gotten testimonies from an Edwards scholar at Harvard, one at the University of Iowa, and from J.I. Packer that this is faithful Edwardsian reproduction. I am not trying to say anything new under the sun. If I did, I wouldn't care if anybody listened to it or not. It's old-time, Spurgeonic, Calvinistic, Edwardsian Christianity in a new dress. Now, what about Edwards? Can I make this stand? Can I show that from the writings of Jonathan Edwards, he was a radically hedonistic person, and his theology is hedonistic? And the word hedonistic is, I'm just taking it in its strict Webster's meaning of pleasure-seeking. A hedonist is a person devoted to the pursuit of pleasure. And that's what I am. That's what Edwards was. That's what you are, if you would admit it. And to be a Christian hedonist simply means to target God as the only satisfying source of joy and satisfaction in the universe. And therein he is greatly glorified, and in no other way. Now, the way I want to approach this is to point out two features of Edwards' thinking that seem contrary to Christian hedonism. The first is his teaching about self-love. He is very critical of the concept of self-love in the 18th century, and yet also at times very affirming. And we must study to separate out what is bad and what is good about self-love. The two focuses I will have is to show you that self-love is inadequate because its branches don't reach high enough to take God into account, and its roots don't go deep enough to find the source of itself in God. And that'll make sense when we get into it. But that's going to be the first part of the paper. The second thing that he refers to that seems out of sync with Christian hedonism is the doctrine of disinterestedness. A very common term in ethical thinking in the 18th century. Disinterested benevolence, disinterested love to God, it was a virtue. Disinterestedness was something they esteemed. And disinterestedness sounds the opposite of Christian hedonism. I stumbled over this for many years, not understanding what I was reading, because I always felt like, oh no, Edwards is not on my side, because he would always say good things about disinterestedness. Well, I have quotes that I'm going to read to you that are going to blow you out of the water to show you that I didn't understand what he was talking about. I never grasped what he meant by disinterestedness. And so many people today sling around these terms. A little learning is a dangerous thing when it comes to Edwards or anybody else. And to say that, look, he attacked self-love, so he's not in favor of Christian hedonism. And look, he's in favor of disinterested, so he's not in favor of Christian hedonism, is to be incredibly naive. So, now we get into it and see whether or not we can make this plain. There is a cultural distance between us and Edwards here, even though self-love is the name of the game in contemporary psychological thought. Self-esteem, self-image, self-love is just everywhere. And so we must be very careful when we get into Jonathan Edwards, lest we import all of our thinking about self-love and self-image and self-esteem into his thinking. And not only is there a cultural distance, but there is a language problem here. Listen to what Edwards says, and he's thinking about the term self-love and others. He says, oh, how is this world darkened, clouded, distracted, and torn to pieces by those dreadful enemies of mankind called words. He was utterly frustrated by the inadequacy of words. This man's thought was just ranging so high, and he would dip down and try to take a human word up into this vision that he had, and it never was adequate. And so he was always qualifying and distinguishing different kinds of things, which made him a very detailed and noteworthy philosopher. So, section number one is called The Inadequacy of Self-Love. Its branches don't reach high enough. And then the second section is going to be called The Inadequacy of Self-Love. Its roots don't go deep enough. So let's just talk first. What did Edwards mean by saying self-love is inadequate as a guide to virtue or as a source of true virtue? He recognized that the term can be used to refer simply to our love for happiness. But his preference, what he preferred, what he liked to do, was use the term negatively for a narrow, selfish performance. Here's what he said in The Nature of True Virtue. Self-love, as the phrase is used in common speech, most commonly signifies a man's regard to his confined, private self, or love to himself with respect to his private interests, that is, without respect to God or other people necessarily. Self-love was ordinarily bad. It was negative. It was what we mean by selfishness, and that's the way he used it often. It was virtually synonymous with selfishness. Now, what makes a selfish person happy is not when others are benefited, but when he has private happiness that increases without any consideration to others. They can go to hell as far as he's concerned, or just be ignored. That pursuit of happiness, which is private and constrained, is what he calls selfishness or self-love. In 1738, he wrote a series of sermons and delivered them to his people on 1 Corinthians 13. These are published now by Banner of Truth under the title Charity and Its Fruits. He took verse 5, which says, "Charity seeketh not her own." And he entitled the sermon on that verse, "The Spirit of Charity, the Opposite of a Selfish Spirit." Now listen to what he says. Quote, "The ruin that the fall brought upon the soul of man consists very much in his losing the nobler, more benevolent principles of his nature and falling wholly under the power and government of self-love." So this is about as bad as you could get in describing self-love. It is the result of the fall. "Sin, like some powerful astringent, contracted his soul to the very small dimensions of selfishness. And God was forsaken, fellow creatures forsaken, and man retired within himself and became totally governed by narrow, selfish principles and feelings. Self-love became absolute master of his soul, and the more noble and spiritual principles of his being took wings and flew away." So self-love in this sense is the vice of selfishness. And people who are governed by self-love, quote, "place their happiness in good things, perhaps, that are confined or limited to themselves, to the exclusion of others. And this is selfishness. This is the thing most clearly and directly intended by that self-love which Scripture condemns." So self-love is a natural trait of fallen man in this sense, and it is evil because even though it might be made happy by something good, say the reading of a novel or golfing or eating or whatever, it might be made happy by something that is not intrinsically evil. Nevertheless, it is evil because it's contracted and confined and narrow and therefore indifferent to other people's blessing and God's glory. But now that raises the question, how broad can the benevolent effects of self-love be before it ceases to be evil by virtue of its narrowness? That's probably a difficult sentence to follow. In other words, if what's evil about self-love is its narrow, confined nature, how broad must it be before it becomes good? What must it take into account? How many people, like most people, would a mother would give her life for her baby? And Edwards would say there is no necessary virtue in that at all, because the baby is a reflection of her own valuing and worth. Her circle of benevolence is very constricted. It doesn't necessarily take God into account at all. And so that can't, in and of itself, without other considerations, be called true virtue. So the question is, well, what does it take to make self-love into true virtue? Or can it be? How high do the branches have to go? This is where I'm getting this idea of the branches don't go high enough. 1755, he preached a sermon on 1 Corinthians 13, and he gave this a radical answer. He says, "Only when self-love embraces the good of the whole universe of being can it be called truly virtuous. And until self-love embraces God, so that now God's glory is a constituent part of its delight, only then can its benevolent acts be called truly virtuous." Which was an utterly radical thing to say. Let me read you, quote, "If there could be a cause like self-love determining a person to benevolence towards the whole world of mankind, or even all created natures throughout the universe, exclusive of union of heart to the general existence and love to God, not derived from that temper of mind which disposes to a supreme regard to Him, nor subordinate to such divine love, it cannot be of the nature of true virtue." In other words, what he said was, even if your self-love for some reason could reach out and embrace all of humanity so that you had a benevolent disposition towards every human being, if you left God out of account, he would say your love is infinitely parochial. I read that to my wife and she just laughed because it is so radical. Only a person with a God-entranced worldview could say, if you embrace the whole human race with love, you are infinitely parochial when you leave God out of account. But it's so reasonable. If you think of the magnitude of God, God compared to all humanity is infinite. Humanity is tiny compared to infiniteness. Therefore, if you love all humans and don't love God, have no delight in His glory, you are infinitely parochial and therefore not virtuous. Well, Norman Fiering, who wrote a tremendous book but is not at all an Edwardsian proponent, I don't even know if he's a believer, University of North Carolina, he said, we may admire the audacity of such a statement, but it is also open to obvious criticism. And then he just proceeded to criticize Edwards in a way that I think misses the point of what Edwards was trying to do. And what Edwards was trying to do in the 18th century is preserve the centrality of God in moral considerations. There were people in the 18th century who were defining morality solely in terms of good to people. And God was left out of account. And Edwards saw where this was leading in its secular implications for history. And he said, I've got to find a way that puts God square at the center and makes Him the essence of true virtue. And so he said, look, you're infinitely parochial until you love God. And somebody who is parochial, we all agree, is not truly virtuous. If you only love white people and hate black people, you're parochial and you're not virtuous. If you only love educated people and not uneducated, you're parochial. And so if you only love humans and you don't love God, you're infinitely parochial and therefore not virtuous. So his whole goal in everything he did, in fact, was to preserve the centrality of God in moral considerations in the 18th century. And he was reading the foremost philosophers of his day as he was trying to do this. So the inadequacy of self-love is that its branches don't reach high enough. They don't take God into consideration. If they did, if self-love reaches that high, it ceases to be evil. Now, we're going to see Edwards in a few minutes take up self-love in a very positive way. But that's the end of the first point, namely the inadequacy of self-love because its branches don't reach high enough. Here's the second part. The inadequacy of self-love, its roots don't go deep enough. Now, we'll try to see what that means. Edwards viewed self-love now sometimes in a very positive way. And I hope that you can see in advance what my point is going to be, namely that what Edwards is really trying to do in this section is strip away from hedonism everything that obscures its radical God-centeredness. I'm going to argue that he's a hedonist through and through, that self-love, when it takes God into account and embraces God as a constituent element of its happiness, is not only good, but it's essential that we pursue happiness or our own love for happiness in that way. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In Charity and Its Fruits, here's what he says. It is not contrary to Christianity that a man should love himself, or, which is the same thing, should love his own happiness. If Christianity did indeed tend to destroy a man's love to himself and to his own happiness, it would therein tend to destroy the very spirit of humanity. That a man should love his own happiness is as necessary to his nature as the faculty of will is, and it is impossible that such a love should be destroyed in any other way than by destroying his being. The saints love their own happiness. Yea, those that are perfect in happiness, the saints and the angels in heaven, love their own happiness. Otherwise, that happiness which God hath given to them would be no happiness to them. If you destroy a man's love to happiness, when God gives him happiness, he would have no happiness. Nothing that he loves or delights in. It's just part of the definition of will, Edward says. The definition of willing is the capacity to be happy and to want to be happy. So he took all this for granted. He took the very existence of human will for granted, and this as part of it. And I find that when I stand up and say this today, that we ought to pursue our happiness and that we can't help but pursue our happiness, I find that many Christians hear it as a kind of new religion or a slipping away from true religion, which shows how far we came from Edwards in the last 200 years. And how much more we follow in a stream of Enlightenment thinking of Immanuel Kant than in the reformed biblical thinking of Jonathan Edwards, who saw that the very essential nature of man is a quester after happiness, and God puts him there as the fountain of satisfaction, and thus gets glory for himself as it echoes back in man's delight. Here's what he says again. That to love ourselves is not unlawful is evident also from the fact that the law of God makes self-love a rule and measure by which our love to others should be regulated. Thus Christ commands, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself, which certainly supposes that we may and must love ourselves. Now let me stop right there in this quote and warn against the contemporary psychologizing of this text. It is constantly misused by those who promote self-esteem. The text means, when it says, love your neighbor as yourself, he's assuming that self-love means the love of your own happiness, the quest for joy. You don't walk out in front of a truck. You eat three meals a day. You take baths. You are caring for yourself and not killing yourself. Therefore, you should make your own zeal for your own happiness the measure of your zeal for other people's happiness. Now back to the quote. The same appears also from the fact that the scriptures, from one end of the Bible to the other, are full of motives that are set forth for the very purpose of working on the principle of self-love. Such are all the promises, the threatenings of the Word of God, its calls and invitations, its counsels to seek our own good, and its warnings to beware of misery. He just says the whole Bible is built on self-love. But now, how does this relate to our love for God, which Edwards argues is so indispensable to true virtue? The quest for happiness seems self-centered to most Christians today, but in fact, Edwards can help us see that the attempt to abandon the quest for happiness is going to result in a worse self-centeredness and a failure to honor God. Now, here's the question that helps us get at this. It's Edwards' question. Whether or no a man ought to love God more than himself? That's a quote from Edwards. He posed it to himself. And now here's his answer. Self-love, taken in its most extensive sense, and love to God are not things properly capable of being compared with one another. This is so important. Because people are always asking you questions that are prejudicing the answer because the terms of the question are not possible to take as they stand, if you're going to be true. So if you ask the question, should a man love God more than himself, you're asking a question that Edward says cannot be answered. Now let me start over and read this again. Self-love, taken in the most extensive sense, and love to God are not properly capable of being compared one with another, for they are not opposites or things entirely distinct from one another. One enters into the nature of the other. Self-love is only a capacity of enjoying or taking delight in anything. Now surely 'tis improper to say that our love to God is superior to our general capacity for delighting in anything. That makes sense? You can't say love to God is superior than the capacity to love God. In other words, self-love is the capacity to delight in a thing, and if that thing is God, then those two things are not at odds. They are in. One is in the other. They don't contrast with each other. So you can never play off self-love in this broad sense against love to God when self-love is treated as our love for happiness. Rather, love to God is the form that self-love takes when God is discovered as the all-satisfying focus of our happiness. Here's the way Norman Fiering captures it. Quote, disinterested love to God is impossible because the desire for happiness is intrinsic to all willing or loving whatsoever. And God is the necessary end of the search for happiness. Logically, one cannot be disinterested about the source and basis of all interest. That's right. I think Edwards would agree with that. But here we get to this word disinterested. Now, Fiering is using the word disinterested there as something that Edwards would reject. But Edwards, in fact, doesn't reject the word disinterested. He uses it. He affirms it. So are we on track with Edwards? Has Fiering really got a hold of Edwards? Edwards is willing to talk about a disinterested love to God. He affirms it, says that's what we should have. But the same ambiguity surrounds the word disinterested that surrounded the word self-love. Self-love could be bad, and it can be good when it's just referring to a love for happiness. Disinterested can be bad, or it can be good. When Edwards speaks of a disinterested love to God, he means this. And I'll try to show you from quotes. He means a love for God in himself rather than a love for God's gifts. All he's doing here is what he did there. He wants to preserve the God-centeredness of love to God. Because there are a lot of people who say they love God when really what they mean is they like what God gives them. They like escape from hell, and they like health and healing, and they like purpose to live for, and they like family and jobs and good things. But I've asked my people often, are you among the number who would be real glad to get to heaven even if you didn't find God there? And there are a lot of Christians who I think would be very content to get to heaven even if they didn't find God there. And Edwards says, disinterested love to God is a love that is ravished by God in his holiness, his beauty, his character, his excellence, not by his gifts primarily. This can be seen most clearly if we take the amazing phrase, disinterested delight, which sounds like an utter contradiction. Disinterested delight. And yet, that's exactly what Edwards will expound. And thus we begin to see what he means by disinterested. Here's a quote from Religious Affections. As it is with the love of saints, so it is with their joy and spiritual delight and pleasure. The first foundation of it is not any consideration or conception of their interest in, and understand from that, their natural benefit from, that is, natural and physical material things they could get from it. Let's start over. The first foundation of it is not any consideration or conception of their interest in divine things, but it primarily consists in the sweet entertainment of their minds, that their minds have, in the view of or contemplation of the divine and holy beauty of these things, as they are in themselves. See, not in the things they give them. But this is indeed the very main difference between the joy of a hypocrite and the joy of a true saint. The former rejoices in himself. Self is the first foundation of his joy. The latter rejoices in God. True saints have their minds, in the first place, inexpressibly pleased and delighted with the sweet ideas of the glorious and amiable nature of the things of God. This is the spring of all their delights and the cream of all their pleasures. But the dependence of the affections of hypocrites is in a contrary order. They first rejoice that they are made much of by God, and then on that ground, he seems in a sort lovely to them. Boy, that last sentence is tailor-made for our day. Hypocrites, the joy of hypocrites is that they are made much of by God. And then on the basis of being made much of by God, they find God in a sort lovely. I hear that again and again when the cross is expounded as a demonstration of your value rather than the value of God's glory being vindicated in the death of his son for sinners like you who are so unworthy. So that I just have a feeling that thousands of people with no conversion are being wooed into thinking God is good because he makes much of them. And since they make much of themselves and God makes much of themselves, they have, in a sense, an affection for God. which is not grounded in anything but natural, unconverted self-love. A paragraph like that puts an end once for all to the thought that disinterested in Edwards means that we should not seek our deepest and highest pleasures in God and be driven on by them till we have no rest at the fountain, or not have any rest until we get to the fountain of his blessings and satisfaction. It's a radically hedonistic paragraph. Perhaps the proof that the love of God can never be played off against the pursuit of happiness in Edwards is the answer to this question: should you be willing to be damned for the glory of God? It was a very common question, and Edwards answered it with a resounding no, and took out of step with many of his Reformed brethren in his day. Let me read you the quote to show you why he would never give in to somebody who forced that dilemma on him. Many ordination candidates were asked in that day, would you be willing to be damned for the glory of God? And the right answer that got them into the ministry was, yes, I would be. And Edwards would never give that answer. Here's his quote. 'Tis impossible for any person to be willing to be perfectly and finally miserable for God's sake. For this supposes love to God is superior to love, self-love, in the most general and extensive sense of self-love, which enters into the very nature of love to God. In other words, he won't let them be pulled apart, because whenever you talk about love to God, you have self-love in its most extensive sense being fulfilled in love to God. If a man is willing to be perfectly miserable for God's sake, then he must be willing to be deprived not only of his natural benefits, but also of that which is indirectly his own, namely God's good, which supposition is inconsistent with itself. For to be willing to be deprived of this latter sort of good is opposite to the principle of love to God itself, from whence such a willingness is supposed to arise. Love to God, if it be superior to any other principle, will make a man forever unwilling, utterly and finally, to be deprived of that part of his happiness which he has in God's being blessed and glorified. And the more he loves him, the more unwilling he will be. So that this supposition that a man can be willing to be perfectly and utterly miserable out of love to God is inconsistent with itself. You cannot be utterly and perfectly miserable for the glory of God. Because if you love the glory of God that much, when he gets glory through your damnation, you will have an element of joy that he gets glory. And it's inconsistent to say that you've got joy in hell that God is being glorified. So Edwards would not be cornered. Now, my response to that question, should a man be willing to be damned for the glory of God, is that is a dreadfully unbiblical question. The Bible will never let you put God in that corner to say he's the kind of God who could even contemplate damning someone who loves his glory that much. And Paul in Romans 9 would not allow himself to answer the question in that way. He did not say that he could be damned for his kinsman according to the flesh. It was an impossible thought, and the grammar of that verse shows that he knows he could never do it. God's not that kind of God. Edwards is very sharp now and realizes that beneath such a love of benevolence, which emerges in that paragraph when he says we should love God's good, beneath the love of benevolence that you have for God, there's also a love of complacence, that is, a love of joy and delight. Let me read you a text from the Miscellany. This love of complacence, delight in God, is a placing of his happiness in a particular object. This sort of love, which is always in proportion to a love of benevolence, is also inconsistent with a willingness to be utterly miserable for God's sake. For if a man is utterly miserable, he is utterly excluded from the enjoyment of God. The more a man loves God, the more unwilling he will be to be deprived of this happiness in God. So there is no such thing in the thought of Edwards as the ultimate abandonment of the quest for happiness. There is no such thing as the ultimate abandonment of the quest for happiness. Disinterestedness is affirmed only to preserve the centrality of God himself as the object of our happiness. Self-love is rejected only when it is conceived as a narrow love for happiness that excludes God. In other words, to use the words of Norman Fiering, the type of self-love that is overcome in finding union with God is specifically selfishness, not the self-love that seeks the consummation of happiness. There's no reason to speak of the inadequacy of self-love, we might think, when it includes God then. But now here we get to one last point about the roots not going deep enough. Let me see if I can sum up where we got so far so we can get your bearings. We've said that self-love is a bad thing if it doesn't reach up high enough to include God as the object of its joy. If it does include God, self-love is defined simply in terms of the capacity for happiness, and you can never play it off against love to God. It is love to happiness now fulfilled in God. Then we went to the word disinterested, and we said, well, when he talks about disinterested love to God, doesn't that mean you don't pursue your own joy? There's some other kind of love to God that doesn't mean pursuing your own delight in God? He would say, no, indeed. What disinterested means is you love God because he's glorious, he's holy, he's beautiful, not because of any secondary benefits that he gives you. Your delight is in him, in fellowshipping with him and in being with him. Now, the last question that I'm going to ask before we conclude with a word of application is, once self-love reaches high enough to embrace God, can it be spoken of as wholly adequate then? And Edwards answers, no, because its roots don't go down deep enough. Now, here's what I mean by that. He asked the question, why do some people put their happiness in God and others don't? And he answers, regeneration is the answer. Some are regenerated and some aren't. And the reason he gave this answer was the reason he did everything he did, namely, to put God not only at the top of ethical considerations, but at the bottom, at the source, as well as the goal of all of our ethical thinking. He recognized a secularizing tendency in the ethics of his day that allowed ethics to be defined without God as the goal and without God as the ground, without God as the cause and source. So Edwards, he asked the ethical teachers of his day, why does one man find pleasure in God and another man doesn't? How do people come to have their true happiness in God? Here's what he said. He observed that a love to God that arises solely from self-love cannot be a truly gracious or spiritual love. For self-love is a principle entirely natural and as much in the hearts of devils as angels, and therefore surely nothing that is the mere result of it can be supernatural and divine. This is really devastating and dangerous for our day, I think. He goes on to say that those who say that all love to God arises solely from self-love, so when you're preaching, for example, all you need to do is appeal to native self-love that is in the soul. That's all you need. He says the problem with that is this. People that say that ought to consider a little further and inquire how the man came to place his happiness in God's being glorified and in contemplating and enjoying God's perfections. How came things to be so agreeable to him that he esteems it his highest happiness to glorify God? If after a man loves God and has his heart so united to him as to look upon God as his chief good, it will be a consequence and fruit of this, that even self-love or love to his own happiness will cause him to desire the glorying and enjoying of God. It will not thence follow that this very exercise of self-love went before his love to God, and that his love to God was a consequence and fruit of that. Something else, entirely distinct from self-love, might be the cause of this, namely, a change made in the views of his mind and relish of his heart, whereby he apprehends the beauty and glory and supreme good of God's nature as it is in itself. So Edwards says that self-love alone can't account for the existence of spiritual love to God. But that prior to the soul's going after God because it wants happiness, something has to happen to the taste buds of the heart so that it recognizes God as satisfying. And that doesn't come from self-love. It doesn't come from anything in the world. It's a miracle called regeneration. Let me read on. Divine love may be thus described. 'Tis the soul's relish of the supreme excellency of the divine nature, inclining the heart to God as the chief good. The first thing in divine love, and that from which everything that pertains to it arises, is a relish of the excellency of the divine nature, which the soul of man by nature has nothing of. When once the soul is brought to relish the excellency of the divine nature, then it will naturally and of course incline to God in every way. In other words, you can start pursuing your happiness in God once your mind is being has been granted to see that God is delightful. Once that the taste buds of your soul have been renovated so that they delight more in God than in praise of man and money and sex and drugs and prestige. It will have benevolence to God. It will be glad that He is happy. It will incline that He should be glorified and that His will should be done in all things, so that the first effect of the power of God in the heart in regeneration is to give the heart a divine taste or sense, to cause it to have a relish of the loveliness and sweetness of the supreme excellency of the divine nature. And indeed, this is all the immediate effect of the divine power that there is. This is all the Spirit of God needs to do in order to a production of all the good effects in the soul. So very simply, in a sentence, I think we can say he's saying this. A capacity to taste a thing must precede our desire for its sweetness. A capacity to taste a thing as sweet must precede our desire for its sweetness. And that's called regeneration in Edwards' theology. And he said then that self-love is regulated, that's his word, by this supernatural taste. Another quote or two. The change that takes place in a man when he is converted and sanctified is not that his love for happiness is diminished. Now here we're getting to the clincher on Christian hedonism. Notice this. What happens in conversion is not that a man's desire for happiness is diminished, but only that it is regulated with respect to its exercises and influence and courses and the objects that it leads to. When God brings a soul out of a miserable state and condition into a happy state by conversion, He gives him happiness that before he had not, namely in God. But He does not, at the same time, take away any of His love for happiness. So the problem with our love for happiness is never that it is too great. The problem with our love for happiness is never that it is too great. The main problem is that it is flowing in the wrong channels. It is targeting the wrong objects because we are not born again. And to be born again means to have the channels shifted, to have God made delectable to the heart so that now the natural impulses of the desire for happiness are channeled towards God because of this miracle of God-wrought regeneration. Now that just leads me to a final comment about the duty of Christian hedonism. It follows then that if this is right, we ought to make it our aim to pursue happiness in God with all of our might. Here's a closing quote or so. God is glorified within Himself these two ways. Now, what He's showing here is that Christian hedonism is rooted in the Trinity. This is the most profound thing about Christian hedonism you could ever say, I think. Now, I couldn't say it to everybody because it is so weighty, but you men will grasp it. God is glorified within Himself in these two ways, by appearing to Himself in His own perfect idea of Himself, or in His Son, who is the brightness of His glory, and by enjoying and delighting in Himself, by flowing forth in infinite love and delight towards Himself, which is the Holy Spirit. Do you see this? He's saying the Trinity is this.
God has a perfect image of himself, and thus his being is reflected back to himself, and he knows himself in the Son. And his being or his love to himself flows out to the Son and is, as it were, impersonated in the Holy Spirit. So the Holy Spirit is God's love for God, and the Son is God's knowledge of God, the Word of God, who's always been there. Now he goes on. So God glorifies himself toward the creatures also in these two ways. One, by appearing to their understanding. That corresponds to his image of himself in the Son. And in communicating himself to their hearts, and in their rejoicing and delighting in and enjoying the manifestations which he makes of himself. God is glorified not only by his glories being seen, but by his glory being rejoiced in. When those that see it delight in it, God is more glorified than if they only see it. He's starting to talk my language here now. His glory is then received by the whole soul, both by the understanding and by the heart. God made the world that he might communicate and the creature receive his glory, and that it might be received both by the mind and by the heart. He that testifies his idea of God's glory doesn't glorify God so much as he that testifies also his approbation of it and his delight in it. Now that's the essence of Christian hedonism. We glorify God more by delighting in his glory than by knowing his glory merely. In other words, the chief end of man is to glorify God by enjoying him forever. This is the essence of Christian hedonism, and the gospel of hedonism is that there's no conflict between God's passion to be glorified and my passion to be satisfied. Here's what he says. Because God infinitely values his own glory, consisting in the knowledge of himself, love to himself, complacence and joy in himself, he therefore valued the image, communication, or participation of these in the creature. And it is because he values himself that he delights in the knowledge and love and joy of the creature as being himself the object of this knowledge, love, and complacence. Thus, God's respect to the creature's good and his respect to himself is not a divided respect. But both are united in one, as the happiness of the creature aimed at is happiness in union with himself. And I think I'll just stop right there, because I think the point is adequately made, and see in the last 5 minutes whether you have any questions. David?
My inference, just see if I'm thinking with you here. The popular doctrine of the separation between the salvation of Christ and the lordship of Christ comes in very clearly here, because if, as the popular drawing of Christ on the throne, if he is not the central focal point of that person's individual, of his life, then his self-love is not yet virtuous. His self-love is not focused on Christ, but it's focused on his ego, and therefore is yet as yet unregenerate.
I certainly explain the unsanctified convert in a different way than that little circle does. And I've never thought of it quite in those terms, but as I understand what you're saying, I would agree with you. The way I draw my first circle with Christ off the throne and a jumble of priorities in the life, and say the unconverted man. The converted man who's not yet very sanctified, I put the cross on the throne and say that unless you confess Jesus as Lord, you're not saved. And so he's on the throne, and then I show all of these other little things out here, not in shape, not in place yet, but little by little, God's lordship is getting victory over those things in his life. So there is, Edwards has to live with unsanctified believers. He admits that there is a reality of an unsanctified believer. He's not a perfectionist. And yet he would say that in that first act of saving faith, there is a genuine taste, small as it may be, for the essence of divine holiness and a resignation to the authority and lordship of God. Then the battle begins, and that lordship, Christ taking rule in the life, begins to take over more and more of the badness and the corruption of the human soul. So I'll have to think more on that little drawing in relationship to self-love and its being virtuous only when it embraces God. But it, what you said sounds right to me. Dennis?
No question that a fellow like Paul, you can sense that he's a Christian hedonist in much that he talks about. Just, I want you to just expound on something that he says in 1 Thessalonians 2, where he describes the Thessalonian people as his joy and his crown.
Yes.
And obviously, he's going to ultimately say that God is his great joy, but help us as pastors to understand how our people can be our joy and our crown.
All right.
With the concept of God being.
The question is part of a much larger one, namely, what is legitimate about any joy in life that isn't directly a joy in God? Ice cream, popcorn, sex in marriage, children, anything. Why are we not idolaters when we admire a sunrise? Now, so I'm give a general answer, which I think answers the question there, 1 Thessalonians 3. I think that any time a human joy, or a joy in a human or created reality, is a springboard to delight in the Creator and is a ray of light that allows your eye to run up into the Creator, it doesn't have to be idolatry. Specifically, if you look at believers, I think what Paul would say, if you ask him that question, is, what I mean when I say they are my joy, I mean that they are the trophies of grace, and nothing excites me like grace. It's the application to the church of 1 Corinthians 15:10 to himself. By the grace of God, I am what I am. And his grace toward me was not in vain, but I worked harder than any of them. Nevertheless, it was not I, but the grace of God which was with me. If you ask God, if you ask Paul, are you accomplishing anything significant in the world? He would say, you bet I am. But it's not I. It's the grace of God within me. And I think if you said, what do you think of that church? He said, I think a lot of them, and I love them, and they are my joy, my delight. I just take great joy in watching them. And then he would say, but what I mean is, God has, by his grace, this way and that way, made those people what they are, and I delight in the evidences of God's grace. If you love the glory of God, you will love the spangles of that glory in the Rocky Mountains, in a little baby's whole hands, in the convert of a church. So I think there's a God-centered way to delight in human things that doesn't commit you to idolatry. Back in the back.
Loving God just for who he is, apart from a gift, is such a foreign concept for many people, and for us in a Christian life. How do we, the pastors, get our people to love God for who he is? And apart from what he's
done. Right. I probably wouldn't. The last sentence is a very unbiblical way of putting it. That is, to get people to love God for who he is apart from what he's done. When you read the Bible, you just have to admit the deeds of the Lord are what is to be brought to mind. I muse upon your great works. I remember your mighty deeds. I call to mind the works of the Lord. So I don't want to be pressed into a kind of maybe a mystical neglect of redemptive history. God has chosen to reveal himself with acts and deeds, and no good thing will he withhold from those who walk uprightly. So, in a sense, I'm not going to try to wean my people wholly away from the consideration of God's gifts and his deeds. But, it's still a real good question. How can I help them not be idolatrous or get beyond the love for the gifts? How can I help them not just want to escape hell, but to really want to be with Jesus? I mean, I just think there are precious few people who would say with the Apostle Paul, to die and be with Christ is far better than the vacation I'm about to take. So few seem to have that mentality. And I think the way to help them is to constantly display the beauty of this person. He is the kind of person whom it is wonderful to be with. And use analogies. analogies of their own family. Just ask a happy husband and wife, if you had to trade the cooking she does for you and the bed she makes for you and the sex, perhaps, that she gives to you, and lose her. If you could have all those and not have her, which would you choose? To just help people get a handle on the beauty of personal relationship. Most people, I think, have had some experience of the warmth of camaraderie with a like-minded person, that if you elevate that a million times to the Godhead and say, and you can have that with the Creator of the universe, who has everything combined in one personality that you like and all the other people that you like, so that to know Him and be with Him would be the most delightful thing in the universe. So I don't want to encourage any of you to just preach being, being of God. Be biblical. If the Bible says He split a sea and therefore ought to be worshipped, say He split a sea. If it says He sent manna in the wilderness so that they wouldn't starve, talk about how He meets physical needs. But then you can always do it in a way that says, and isn't He wonderful because of that? Isn't He a great and holy and worthy God? So that if He ever took that manna away, you'd still have Him. And then you quote a verse like the Psalm, Thy steadfast love is better than life. So that if they lost everything in this life, family, job, health, prestige, and still had God, they'd have everything. If we start to feel it ourselves, it'll come out, I think, in our preaching. John, you stop us whenever you want to, but we'll see if there's another question. It looks like maybe one more then.
I didn't want to take anybody else's
turn. Sure.
In the church, just brief example. You have a situation that requires discipline in the church, and you have elders or deacons who are very reticent to exercise discipline because of their great compassion and their great love for this individual. Are we not observing here, because their attitude, a sense of unvirtuous self-love, rather than if they truly loved God and He was vocal to them and delighted themselves in God, they would not refrain from doing the spiritual loving thing. The individual. Is this not another way that self-love is shown to be non-virtuous?
Yeah, and masquerades as compassion.
Right.
Yes. Now, you won't get anywhere with those people talking like that. But if you go to 1 John chapter 5, verse 2 and 3, and say, by this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep His commandments, you've got them. I mean, that text is something that very few compassionate people will listen to. I mean, I'm talking about artificially compassionate who sort of obviate all serious demands upon people because of compassion. That text, most everybody says you can know that you love God if you keep His commandments. That's not what the text says. The text says, by this we will know that we love the children of God. In other words, it introduces the possibility that we're confused about what love is, and they are. By this we will know that we love the children of God when we love God, i.e., follow through on what He said, even when it's hard, when it hurts. Now, I'm not by nature a real compassionate person, so I want to learn from the supposedly compassionate people in my church and feel the kind of things they seem to feel anyway when we do carry through with tough love. But I'm just pointing that out to say that'd be a better strategy than philosophical language that we've been using this morning. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this message by John Piper, pastor for preaching at Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Feel free to make copies of this message to give to others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission. We invite you to visit Desiring God online at www.desiringgod.org. There you'll find hundreds of sermons, articles, radio broadcasts, and much more, all available to you at no charge. Our online store carries all of Pastor John's books, audio, and video resources. You can also stay up to date on what's new at Desiring God. Again, our website is www.desiringgod.org, or call us toll free at 1-888-346-4700. Our mailing address is Desiring God, 2601 East Franklin Avenue, Minneapolis, Minnesota, 55406. Desiring God exists to help you make God your treasure, because God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in Him.